Good afternoon. It's a Juno afternoon. I'm your host for this Friday afternoon, Andy Klein with you. And today we're going to be talking to folks from the Marie Drake Planetarium about the Great American Solar Eclipse. Also, Maddie Nolan Grimes is here from the Juno Family Health and Birth Center. We're going to be talking to the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center folks. We're going to be doing the fireside lecture on Seward's Folly 150 years later. And also cast members from Perseverance Theater's new show, To Kill a Mockingbird. That's all coming up, plus music, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, and so much more here on a Juno afternoon, right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Hannah Colton in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Oregon Board of Education has approved the state's first deal allowing a local school district to keep its native mascot. The Associated Press reports the board Thursday unanimously approved an agreement between the Banks School District and the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde. The deal allows the district to keep the name Braves, but they have to drop the Indian head image and implement a native history curriculum developed by the Grand Ronde. A state law in 2016 required districts to do away with native mascots by this summer unless they get the support of any one of Oregon's 9 federally recognized tribes. Oregon Public Broadcasting reported last week at least 6 other school districts are working with 2 tribes toward similar agreements. A uranium mine 6 miles outside Grand Canyon National Park has filled with water from a wet winter. An environmental group and 2 tribes are concerned with how the mine company is dealing with it. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
The mining company Energy Fuels is pumping the water into a mist over its containment pond to encourage evaporation. The Sierra Club is worried about the mist falling on the nearby forest and a Havasupai sacred site. Energy Fuels spokesman Curtis Moore says since the company was criticized for the practice, they're shutting off the mist now when the winds pick up.
They're claiming that there's contaminated water. That's a pretty loaded term to describe water that you can almost drink. We're addressing it properly and in accordance with all the laws and regulations.
The EPA says uranium levels in water lower than 0.03 parts per million is safe to drink. Tests show the pond water has levels between 0.04 and 0.09. The Sierra Club was also concerned about the water trucked across the Navajo Nation to a uranium processing facility in southern Utah. The Navajo Nation has a law that prohibits the transport of radioactive material. Cameron Chapter President Milton So said his community wasn't notified of a transport. He said in a statement this week, quote, "As the Navajo Nation, we have dealt with uranium since the Cold War and are still dealing with mines left behind by irresponsible people. The last thing we need is for another mine transferring it through our communities." Energy Fuels says the company is using public roads. For National Native News, I'm Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
Same-sex marriage is now legal in the Osage Nation in Oklahoma after an historic referendum this week. The Osage News reports 52% of Osage voters approved a change to tribal law that recognizes marriage as a personal relation between 2 persons. It was the first time the Osage Nation held a referendum to amend tribal law. Voter turnout was just shy of 10%. Tribal leaders and advocates say they're pleased with a recent federal court decision reaffirming tribal custody rights under the Indian Child Welfare Act. David Simmons is director of government affairs and advocacy for the National Indian Child Welfare Association. He says last week's dismissal of a case is the latest setback for the conservative Goldwater Institute, which has filed several as yet unsuccessful legal challenges to ICWA around the country.
If this is the strategy that they're using, and these are the claims that they're making, and the courts are not receptive to those, if I were them, I would be starting to wonder, why do we want to continue to bring these lawsuits, you know, tie up some of these cases and the fate of children for months and even years at a time, when clearly the courts at this point have not shown to be receptive to their arguments.
The Gila River Indian community lauded last week's ruling, and in a statement this week, Navajo Vice President Jonathan Nez said the Navajo Nation will continue to advocate for ICWA and the protection of Native children in custody cases. Those comments come after appeals court Judge Neil Wake rejected a broad challenge to the 1978 law designed to keep Indian children from adoption to non-Indian families. For National Native News, I'm Hannah Colton.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
The Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Touring Department welcomes the Gathering of Nations Youth Expo New Mexico, April 28th and 29th. Information on services and the Gathering of Nations at siabq.org.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This week's Friday Fireside Chat at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center is the final presentation of the 2017 season. Historian and architect Wayne Jensen will commemorate the 150th anniversary of Alaska's purchase from Russia. Join the Forest Service for this free lecture on March 24th at 6:30 p.m. or at 8 p.m. Please use the stairs or outdoor ramp because the elevators are closed for construction. Call 789-0097 for details. Come on out and love your glacier.
In my eyes, indisposed, in disguise, as no one knows, hides the face, lies the snake, and the sun in my disgrace.
Now, the classic Stephen Eady cover of Soundgarden's Black Hole Sun. We're going to talk about what you could describe as a black hole. Sun is going to be the total eclipse of the sun. It's happening August 21st, and Steve Kosis is here from the Marie Drake Planetarium, and a visiting astronomer, Dennis Mamana, got it right, even though I had that other song in my head, is here, a visiting astronomer from San Diego. Steve, thanks so much for coming in, and Dennis, welcome to Juneau.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Love it here.
So this is obviously, I mean, for people who are excited about astronomy and about the skies, this is one of those amazing events that happens only a couple times in a lifetime. Although you, Steve, have said that you've seen 8 different examples of total solar totality of an eclipse. Is
exactly.
Right?
I've been under the moon shadow. Thank you, Andy, for having me here.
Yeah,
I've been
sure.
under the moon shadow about 30 minutes. And so this eclipse, I'm going to view it from Madras, Oregon, and it'll be a little over 2 minutes. So I'll have 32 minutes under the moon shadow. And a total solar eclipse is the most awesome celestial spectacle you can see. You don't need any optical aid. You can experience it with your senses, and it's an incredible thing. It should be on everyone's bucket list.
Yeah, yeah. And so what is it that makes it so exciting for you?
Well, it's just everything, the lighting, the change in the temperature, the spectacle of seeing a black hole sun in the sky where the sun used to be, and the stars and planets coming out, and the twilight. You see lighting along the horizon as it happens, too.
Right.
And it's extremely trippy light.
Yeah,
when
right.
It happens.
Yeah. So, Dennis, tell me a little bit about it. It's happening August 21st, and it's going to be kind of a swath across North America, right?
Yeah, all of North America will see an eclipse. Only a very small path of across the U.S., the mainland, from Oregon down through Nebraska and then down through Tennessee and South Carolina, that a 70-mile-wide swath will, if you are in that swath of land, you will experience a total eclipse. And that's where you want to be. You don't want to. Partial eclipses are fine. They're interesting. But a total eclipse is where you want to be. People who say, I think I've seen a total solar eclipse, have not.
Right.
I mean, you can always tell because you have to be in just the right place at the right time to see it. And it's spectacular.
Yeah. So what is it exactly? I mean, I think I know what it is, but explain a little bit about what it is.
Well, the moon casts its shadow onto the Earth. And in the case of this particular eclipse, that shadow will be about 70 miles wide or so. And when you are in that shadow, that means the sun gets completely blocked out by the moon. Now, if you are elsewhere on the continental U.S. or in Canada, you're going to see a partial eclipse. That is something you have to have solar filters. You have to hold the solar filter up to block the sun's light. When totality occurs, when the moon is completely knocked out the sun's light, that's when you take the filters away and you can look at that with your naked eye.
Now, explain to me the. It's an interesting thing how the relative sizes of the moon and sun kind of line up perfectly, so that the sun, so that the moon blocks out the sun almost. Right. I mean, describe that a little bit.
That's a temporary thing,
right.
By the way. You know, it wasn't always that way. The moon was larger in the sky than the sun, and it is receding from the Earth. At maybe, what is it, like a centimeter every century or something like that. I don't know exactly what the number is. But in millions of years, total eclipses will not occur. But in fact, yeah, the moon and sun do look almost the same size in the sky, about half a degree across. And it's purely coincidental, of course. The sun is 400 times larger than the moon, and it's 400 times farther away. Purely coincidental. Situation.
Is that moon shadow, as you described it as a 70-mile kind of swath, can that be larger or smaller depending on the position of the moon?
Exactly, yeah. When the moon is at its closest to us, it can create a larger shadow. If the sun is farther, the sun is closer, moon is closer, moon is farther, whatever, this combination of things. Also, the angle at which the shadow hits the spherical Earth can create a much larger swath of shadow as well. So, yeah. You have to figure that for every location on the Earth, every eclipse.
So it actually in Oregon might be slightly a different size slightly than in Tennessee.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, in Oregon, totality, the point where the moon has completely blocked the sun, is about 2 minutes long. In Tennessee, it's on the order of 2 minutes 40 seconds, something like that. So yeah, it's that the size is changing and the length of eclipse is changing. Exactly. It has to do with the geometry of the Earth-Moon-Sun system and also the curvature of the Earth and which way the shadow is coming in, and it's rather complex.
How often does this sort of thing happen?
You get a total solar eclipse back maybe every year and a half or so, somewhere on the Earth. The shadow usually doesn't fall someplace interesting, out in the middle of nowhere usually. But this one, right across the U.S., first time since February 26, 1979. And even Juno will see a partial eclipse from here.
Yeah, interesting.
And we'll see total, though.
That's
you're going to have to wait a while for that.
So tell me some of the different phenomena and things that people should look for if they happen to be in the totality. I guess I have two questions. One is, what will people sort of see in Juno? What will be the difference? How will people know? And then what are some of the other phenomena that happen in the totality of a solar eclipse?
Well, in Juno, it will be a partial eclipse, maybe, 60%, something like that. And what you will see, basically, if with a proper solar filter or a pinhole projector, for example, you will see a crescent sun. That's what you will see at mid-eclipse. You'll see shadows on the ground will look a little sharper. The sky, the air will take on a strange steely look to it. It's interesting. But when you're at a total eclipse and during that, and you see all those partial phase things as well. But during totality, Steve mentioned some of the things. I mean, the sun goes away in the middle of the daytime. That ain't supposed to happen, right?
Yeah.
And all of nature reacts to that. The air cools down. The sky darkens a bit. You can see stars and planets, some of the brighter ones. You get this 360-degree sunset colors all the way around you. You see the outer atmosphere of the sun called the corona, something you cannot see otherwise.
Right.
And it is, without question, the most alien phenomena you will ever experience on this planet. And you will remember it for the rest of your life. Unlike a partial eclipse, you will remember it.
And is it a time when certain scientific study can be done that can't be done at other times?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's scientists, travel the world with instruments to measure things about the corona.
The corona, especially.
Yeah, you can't see it any other time.
Just on that question, Einstein's general theory of relativity was verified in 1918 by observations of stars around an eclipsed sun.
Oh, that's really...
And also, let me just say, being in totality is like winning the lottery, while being in a partial stage is like coming close to winning the lottery. So they're totally discontinuous, one or the other.
Or maybe coming in, ninth or something.
Okay, fine.
get $1,000 or something. Yeah, right. Well, so that's interesting. So, and then, Dennis, tomorrow night, that's tonight, that's the presentation's happening tonight at 7 o'clock. It's $5 to get in at the Marie Drake Planetarium. And then tomorrow night you're going to be doing a presentation on the Big Dippers, especially. Oh. So what are some of the kind of things about the Big Dipper that people maybe don't know?
Hard to imagine I'm going to spend an entire presentation on the Big Dipper, but it's really amazing.
Yeah.
The Big Dipper is quite a celestial icon for us here in the Northern Hemisphere. The Big Dipper is not only an interesting star grouping to look at, it's got some interesting history to it, but it also has some good astronomy going on in the vicinity of the Big Dipper that astronomers have been studying for a long time. So it really is kind of an interesting thing. You go outside on a clear night and actually see it with your eyes, but it has a lot of stories to tell.
So, and then what are the stars that make up the Big Dipper, and what are sort of some of the things that when you're looking at the Big Dipper, what are you really kind of looking at?
Well, what you're looking at is something called the Stellar Association. It's the Big Dipper is not a constellation. It's actually what we call an asterism. It's a group of stars that looks like something. But the five stars, the inner stars of the Big Dipper, not the two stars on the very end, they're what we call part of a stellar association. A group of stars is held together very, very loosely by gravitation. They're actually moving along the same path. And so over long periods of time, that means the Dipper will change its shape. And so that's one of the
when
things
we look at the Big Dipper, we're not, it's so, you know, like I'm a novice when it comes to this stuff, but when I look at it, I almost, you know, you almost think about it like, well, it's just a flat plane, right? But obviously yeah. Those stars are completely depth wise and that sort of thing are massively far away
trillions of miles apart from each other.
Yeah.
And it's purely an illusion that you see it. If you're standing in the room and you look around you, you see certain things that appear to form a shape. You can draw lines between certain things.
Right.
But if you move to the other side of the room, that illusion is not there anymore. That shape's not there anymore. And it's the way it is with the stars. Of course, we're stuck here on the Earth, so we can't do that. But if you could, you could fly around the side of the Big Dipper. Yeah, it's not a Dipper at all. It's just a bunch of random stars that our mind does not like randomness.
Right.
So it will connect things whether they're connected or not.
Yeah, we've been connecting dots of stars in the sky since we could look
like
up.
Just like when you're laying in bed looking up at the ceiling tiles and suddenly a face appears. Holy cow, what the heck is going on? That's the mind connecting random dots that it doesn't like randomness.
And it's the North Star that forms that brightest star in the Big Dipper, right? Is that correct?
No, the North
or
Star
is Polaris.
North Star Polaris is not part of the Big Dipper.
Oh, it's not, okay.
You actually can use the
That's
Big Dippers.
That's off the... Okay, yeah.
You can use the Big Dipper's pointer stars, we call them, to find the North Star. But Polaris, the North Star, is actually part of the Little Dipper.
Okay.
It's the end of the handle
of the
Little
Dipper.
Okay.
And tell me about Polaris. Is that close to us? Is it far away?
Polaris is very, very far away.
But it's just a massive star, and that's why it's so bright.
Hundreds of trillions of miles away.
Uh-huh.
It's just a very, very massive star, very big star. Very bright star, and it's the fact that you can see it as far away as it is tells you it's really bright.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but in our sky, it's a very faint star.
When you
look in the sky, and you can, you know, if you're in a city with lights, chances are you're not even going to be able to
see the North Star.
It's so faint. People have this concept that the North Star is the brightest thing in the sky, and that's just complete nonsense.
Right.
It's not true.
Right.
It's one of the faintest stars.
But used for navigation and sort
when you,
of,
when
yeah.
you face it, you are facing true north.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that helps you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, fascinating stuff. Dennis Mamana and Steve Kosas, thanks so much for coming in. It's two presentations. The one on the total solar eclipse is happening tonight at 7 o'clock at Marie Drake Planetarium, and tomorrow night on the Big Dipper at 7 o'clock. The visiting astronomer from San Diego, Dennis Mamana, is here. And thanks so much for coming in and talking to us about this stuff. And have a great lecture. I'm sure you'll get lots of great questions from folks who are fascinated about both of these celestial phenomena. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Andy Klein.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you. Face like the snake. Yeah.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Joined now by Maddie Nolan Grimes, who's the director of Juno Family Health and Birth Center. Maddie, thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Andy.
You guys are going to be doing a special movie presentation on Monday. Is something you do every year?
We are. So this will be the third year that we do this movie showing. So every year we kind of like to bring something to Juno that talks a little bit about out-of-hospital birth and kind of exposes people to that culture and that world. So this year we'll be showing a movie called Midwife, and mm-hmm. it's specifically a look into the world of home birth. So
when you talk about just the subject, we'll talk about the movie in a minute, but when you talk about the subject in general about out-of-hospital birth, what are some of the common themes or maybe misperceptions you're trying to get to or those kinds of things? What are some of the things that people maybe think about that you're trying to say, well, actually, it's more like this?
Yeah, I think a lot of people really are concerned about safety when you're outside of the hospital, because it is such a big part of our society that when you get pregnant, you go see a doctor or an obstetrician and go have your baby in the hospital. But really, women have been having babies at home for as long as we've had homes. So we like to kind of show people that it is possible to have your baby at home, that midwives are safe, we're well-trained in emergencies, we've done lots of training. Just kind of exposing people to the world of midwifery.
Yeah. And what is the movie about specifically? This one's called Midwife, so it sounds like it kind of handles the whole thing, but you were saying it kind of concentrates a little bit more on the actual home birth.
It does. So it focuses a lot more on home birth, and it's following a midwife who is just out of her training, so she's just passed her graduate boards and is kind of exploring the world of being a small business owner and attending women at home by herself. So it's got some really beautiful bursts in it, from things where it goes totally completely well and things that maybe deviate a little bit from normal, and it shows how well she's been trained to handle those emergencies on her own.
Yeah, right. And how do you go about picking the films or figuring out which films you're going to play for this every year?
It's a little bit of a throwing darts at a dartboard.
Right.
So David Otteson, who owns Rainbow Foods, is the chair of our board. And so David and I usually will kind of scour the internet to see what movies have been published or what things we would be interested in watching. And so this year we kind of came up with a short list, and this one was on our list, and I watched it, and it was just great. It was a good movie.
Yeah, so Cool. And are you always looking for movies that are recent, or do you sometimes dip back into the archives, or?
We've definitely pulled some things back from the archives before. So our first video really focused a lot on the out-of-hospital birth movement in Australia, and then we moved on to a documentary of a woman named Ina Mae Gaskin. So this one is definitely one of our newer movies that we've shown before.
Are there guidelines that you give to people in general about when they're considering home birth, what makes them a good candidate for home birth, or what makes them, or, you know, those kinds of things?
Definitely. So women who are planning home birth need to be low risk. So usually that means that they don't have really significant health complications. They've got one baby inside of them, so we can't attend twins, and that their baby has made it to being head down by the end of their pregnancy. And past that, we do just kind of like to look at the space and make sure that it seems reasonable, mm-hmm. that there's mm-hmm. enough space for a woman to labor comfortably. And then in the case that anything did ever go south, like that we would need EMTs or have to get to the hospital quickly, that we would be in a location where we can do that with reasonable assurance.
Right, I see. So you want, yeah, so that makes a lot of sense. And then are there certain practices that you are able to employ when you're doing a home birth that maybe is a harder thing to do if someone was having a hospital birth?
I think the biggest thing that's different about home birth is that woman being able to be in her own element. So we don't do continuous monitoring where you're strapped to monitors or hooked up to an IV pole, and I think that just totally changes the dynamic of labor. And it really is a woman-led process. So we try to take our cues from the expectant mother and her family or support people that she wants around with her, so that she really is kind of calling the shots. You know, we're in her space. We're really trying to honor and respect her wishes that whole time.
So it's just trying to keep the atmosphere a calm atmosphere, a comfortable and comforting atmosphere for the mother to be, and for the family and the entire family. I have a little experience in this because my daughter was born at home, but that was many, many, many years ago now. But I remember it being a great experience and a calming experience in that way.
Definitely. And there's a lot to be said about not having to leave your house when you're having contractions. You know, any woman who's right. been through labor doesn't really like the idea of getting in a car with with heavy contractions.
Yes, so. We've all. I think I might have been close to born in a taxi cab, you know, many years ago. But that's right. We've all heard those kind of stories before. Well, so one more time, tell me a little bit about the times and how people can go see this movie called Midwife on Monday.
Yeah, so Midwife is going to be shown on Monday. We'll be at the Gold Town Nickelodeon. So there will be snacks and things available for purchase through Gold Town. And then admission to the movie is by donation. So there's no required charge for entry. We really just want people to
great.
Come.
Is it 7 o'clock? Is
Monday
that what
at 7.
Monday at 7
yep.
o'clock. Okay, so you can go and see Midwife, a new movie about midwifery and especially about home birth. And Maddie Nolan Grimes is the director of the Juno Family Health and Birth Center. Maddie, thanks so much for coming in and have a great showing of your movie.
Great, thanks.
Okay. Coming up next, here's Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keillor.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 24th of March, 2017. It was on this day in 1882, the early microbiologist Robert Koch announced that he had found the bacterium responsible for tuberculosis, a disease that, at the time of his discovery, killed off 1 in 7 people. It was believed to be an inherited condition, but Koch believed it was a contagious illness. He had already done work in bacteriology. He had identified the bacteria responsible for cholera and anthrax, and eventually he isolated the cause of tuberculosis and delivered his results to a crowd of scientists in a lecture hall. He brought his entire laboratory to the room to replicate his method on the spot, and the room was left stunned by his work. There were no questions at the end. Instead, the scientists all lined up to see the bacteria for themselves through the microscope. Paul Ehrlich, the chemist, called the lecture the most important experience of my scientific life. Koch got the Nobel Prize in Physiology in 1905 for his work with tuberculosis, which today, thanks to antibiotics, the death rate hovers at less than 4%. It's the birthday of the poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti, born in Bronxville, New York, 1919. His mother French, his father Italian. The father died when Ferlinghetti was 6 months old. His mother was committed to an asylum, and he was brought up in France by his aunt. Served as a Navy lieutenant commander during World War II. Moved to San Francisco, opened City Lights Books, where he published Allen Ginsberg's Howl and other poems in 1956. Ferlinghetti, author of many books of poems himself, including Pictures of the Gone World, A Far Rockaway of the Heart, and A Coney Island of the Mind. And it's the birthday of the journalist Malcolm Muggeridge, born in Croydon, Surrey, England, 1903, editor for many years of the humor magazine Punch. Eventually he left after he got tired of his staff, which he referred to as all anguished men who were trying to discover what, if anything, was funny. Malcolm Muggeridge, who said it was a somber place, haunted by old jokes, life, as I discovered, holds no more wretched occupation than trying to make the English laugh. Here's a poem for today by A.E. Housman. Loveliest of trees, the cherry now is hung with bloom along the bough and stands about the woodland ride wearing white for Eastertide. Now, of my 70 years and 10, 20 will not come again. Take from 70 springs a score, it only leaves me 50 more. And since to look at things in bloom, 50 springs are little room, about the woodlands I will go to see the cherry hung with snow. A.E. Housman's poem, Loveliest of Trees, from A Shropshire Lad, from the collected poems of A.E. Housman, published by Henry Holt and Company, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, you can subscribe to the Poetry Magazine podcast and the Poetry Off the Shelf podcast in the iTunes Store or listen at poetryfoundation.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The Juno World Affairs Council, in partnership with the Rotary Clubs of Juno and the Open World Leadership Center of Washington, D.C., present Mongolia Today, Profile, Strengths, and Politics, with Mongolian Parliament member Dzogbatyr Damdin, Monday, March 27th at 5 o'clock at 360. Mr. Dzogbatyr is a former cabinet minister and newly elected member of the Mongolian Parliament, the state Great Khural. His focus is the development of responsible, accountable, open, and efficient government institutions. He will give us a primer on his nation, its government, and its future, and then take our questions along with a whole group of his fellow parliamentarians. That's Monday, March 27th at 5 o'clock at 360 North Studios. JWAC, bringing the world to Juno.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, your host for this Friday, and joining me next is Wayne Jensen from Jensen, Yorba, and Lott, and also an amateur historian, although he pointed out not as amateur as I am an astronomer. Rightly so.
Thanks, Andy.
But Wayne, thanks so much for coming in, and you have an interest in and are actually going to be giving a lecture tonight on Seward's Folly. We describe the purchase of Alaska as Seward's Folly because of Seward himself. So let's start there. I know it's 150 years we're going to be celebrating.
Right. You know, Monday is Seward's Day officially as a state holiday, but next Thursday, the 30th, is actually the 150th anniversary of the treaty that Seward signed with the Russian minister Eduard Destakel. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that name right, but I'm going with it. and they signed that at 4 o'clock in the morning on March 30th. And,
4 in the morning?
4 in the morning. Well, it's an interesting story. Russia had actually wanted to or considered trying to sell it to the United States in the 1850s. But, you know, it's a little thing like the Civil War got in the way. And so after the Civil War in 1867, Russia decided that they would see again if the United States was interested, and you know, they were. And Seward was the Secretary of State, so the President, Andrew Johnson, authorized him to go ahead and negotiate with the Russian minister and see if they could come up with a deal. And the President had authorized Seward to get at least $7 million, or to not spend more than $7 million. The Russian czar had told his minister that he needed at least $5 million. Of course, they didn't know that, you know, each other.
Sure.
And so they started negotiating, and Seward started at five and quickly went to five and a half, and they settled on seven, which was happened to be Seward's maximum number.
Yeah.
So the minister wired back to the czar because the transatlantic telegraph had just been installed, so he was able to send a telegram.
Were they in D.C.?
They were in D.C.
Okay.
They were in D.C., yeah.
So was it the Russian ambassador?
He called him a minister.
Minister.
So it was like the ambassador.
But he was kind of stationed in D.C.?
He was in D.C. He was permanently. He was like an ambassador.
I see.
Like he had today. And he and Seward had known each other for a long time. They'd actually worked together on some other things and were friends, actually. Mm-hmm. Seward was a friend of everybody back there.
He was a statesman. I mean, he was such a statesman, and I don't think he's necessarily an underrated figure in American history because I think a lot of people do know about him.
Right.
But he's certainly an incredibly important figure in American history.
Very important figure. So anyway, the czar had wired back to Destakel and said, "Yeah, let's go ahead, deal with it. Seven million sounds okay, and let's get together." So Destakel came to Seward's house at about 10 o'clock at night and said he just received approval from the czar that we could negotiate, you know, final negotiations. And so He said, I'll meet you at your office tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, and we can finalize that. And Seward, knowing that the Congress was about to adjourn, said, why wait till tomorrow? Let's meet tonight.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
They met at 7 at midnight, ironed out a few extra things, finally settled on the price of $7.2 million, which is another story, but settled at 7.2, and they signed it at 4 o'clock in the morning in the State Department.
It's amazing in a way that it seems like it actually was a pretty quick deal for the size of it and for what was happening.
It was. At the time, Russia and the United States were pretty strong allies. Russia had shown...
Kind of trading allies? Is that
Well, trading to a degree, but more or less, Russia had shown some force during the Civil War that kind of kept, told some of the European countries that, don't mess with the United States here. If you do, you might have to deal with us too, because one of the problems that Seward faced, or that the Lincoln administration faced, was that they didn't want any European or any foreign country to recognize the Confederate States, because that would have meant that they recognized them as an independent country, and with all the international laws dealing with trade and everything else, that would have been a big deal.
But there was a lot of incentive because of all the commerce
that the South had, and the European countries wanted that. But, Seward was very instrumental in keeping them from recognizing the South as an independent country, and Russia showed some support for that. They actually anchored a few of their warships, some in New York Harbor and some others in San Francisco Harbor, and said, yep.
Right.
We kind of like this United States as the way it is. So
that was kind of the deal making happened there.
Mm-hmm.
So then how long after that did the transfer really take place?
Well, it was a series of things. The first thing was that the treaty had to go to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to get approval, and that took about 10 days, which is interesting. You talked about the Seward's folly, and there's this perception that it was very unpopular. It passed the Foreign Relations Committee, moved it out of their committee and to the whole Senate. It passed 37-2, so it was pretty well done.
So where did that folly, where did that come in?
There were some people that didn't really like President Johnson, and
I mean, he was an unpopular bad president.
Yeah, well,
in a lot of ways.
there's one thing I read was that Seward had the distinction of serving for perhaps the most popular president, or the best president, and the worst.
Yeah.
In two different terms, as Secretary of State. So,
right.
And Lincoln, and then Johnson. But it passed out of that, passed the Senate. Then it was signed by, and interestingly enough, they made two copies, one written in French, which was one of the official languages of Russia, and English. The president signed both of those. Then they had to send that back. They couldn't wire that. They had to send it all the way back to St. Petersburg for the Tsar to sign it.
Did that take a couple months? Or
it took to like June.
Okay,
yeah, it took to like June. It finally got back in June, I believe it was. And then, they'd all signed it, so it actually went into effect about that time. The appropriation, however, was up to the House of Representatives, and they, didn't get around to do it for almost 15 months. They didn't get around it till like the next July. There were some people in the House that didn't like it,
mm-hmm.
And thought, well, you can't have a treaty until we appropriate the money. But in reality, they had signed it, and the Senate, who's responsible for treaties, had signed it, and they ended up appropriating the
money. So once it was signed and once the money was appropriated, did it make an immediate impact here on the ground in Alaska, or did it take many years, or did it take the discovery of gold?
It took some time. It's a pretty rocky transition. The treaty allowed for the Russians who wanted to stay here could stay here and become U.S. citizens. Most of them, I think, left. And there were people that came here, but there weren't any real settlers like there were in some of the, western states where people came to settle. They didn't come just to fish or log or gold mining. Gold mining is probably the thing, the gold discoveries, which weren't that far away. I mean, was 1880.
Yeah.
This was 1867, so just a decade or more away that that they really started to, you know, look for gold, and there had been some discoveries. And so that's probably the big thing that happened. And, you know, and maybe the gold, not the gold miners weren't necessarily settlers, but the people that were selling to the gold miners were.
So, right, right.
So that's what generated, several of the communities.
And as Alaska started getting this kind of, this westward expansion, this manifest destiny, was it southeast that started getting settled first? Is that how it kind of mm-hmm. grew in?
Yeah, well, Sitka was settled mm-hmm. before, because the Russians had, developed settlements in Kodiak, and Sitka in particular, and they had been in the Prince William Sound and the Pribilof Islands and different places. But probably their biggest settlement was in Sitka. So Sitka was New Archangel, according to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, and Wrangell, there were forts also. There was a Fort Wrangell, and there were several native villages, of course, all over
sure,
southeast.
Yeah.
But there was a Fort Tongass, which is at the border between British Columbia and Alaska, 5440, and that was right
okay.
at that area.
Right, right.
So there were some of the forts that turned into U.S. forts, and they were customs things, and, they were at borders. But I think it was probably the gold mine, the gold discoveries that really brought the real rush to Alaska.
When you discuss the Seward's Folly with people or in your presentation, is there some main thing that you're trying to, like a misperception you're trying to rectify? Is there some main theme that you try to make sure that people understand going away?
Well, I think I want to bring people the awareness how important Seward was in U.S. history. I mean, he played a really important role in the Civil War and in Lincoln's administration.
Of course, was an attempted assassination,
which killed his
son-in-law, right?
The assassination of Lincoln.
Right.
They attacked Seward as well. They didn't kill his son. His son was actually there. His son, though, was seriously injured.
Seriously stabbed.
And some others were, too. And Seward was seriously injured.
Gruesomely injured in the face. And,
right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And Vice President Johnson at the time was targeted, but the guy didn't go through with it.
Yeah.
So, there was some serious damage there. And, of course, Lincoln died the next morning. This happened on April 14th, and Lincoln died at about 7 o'clock in the morning.
It is interesting to think that just, that's a time of intense turmoil in the United States. Post-Civil War, Reconstruction is happening. There's all this activity happening, and in this kind of maelstrom of activity, we buy Alaska.
And
there's this massive purchase of the land size.
It took a couple of years, the interesting that the assassination and everything else, the surrender, Lee's surrender was April 9th, and then April 14th was the attack on Seward and Lincoln. And the whole country was kind of in turmoil.
Mm-hmm.
But, I think a credit to our democracy is we
held
continued
together.
On.
Yeah.
We held together. And so,
interesting times, and Wayne Jensen will be talking about that tonight at 6:30 and then again at 8 o'clock at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. It's the Fireside Lecture. And it's all about Seward's Folly, 150 years later. The official anniversary is actually on the 30th, as you were saying, but we're celebrating it on Monday as a state holiday. Wayne Jensen, thanks so much for coming in, and have a great lecture tonight.
Thanks a lot. Hope to see people there.
Sure. Coming up next, here's Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. The naturalist John Hay asks, is it not possible to follow the light through the medium of a bird? Without them, the days would go by without definition. Sometimes it does feel as if we'll never emerge from a featureless murk of dark days. But winter's weak light is finally beginning to strengthen, and some birds, long absent, have begun their journey north, coming back to us. Here's what to look and listen for as we approach the time when day and night are equal. Look for the return of tree swallows, with their metallic blue-green backs, white throats, and notched tails. Ornithologist David Allen Sibley describes their song as a repeated series of clear, sweet whistled phrases. This month also brings phoebes. Eastern phoebes east of the Rockies. and Say's Phoebes in the west. Bluebirds are arriving too, both eastern and western, and they're all looking for cavities in which to nest. So be of good cheer. The birds and spring are coming back.
Today's show is brought to you by Whiteflower Farm, a family-owned mail-order nursery offering a wide range of perennials, annuals, and shrubs for spring planting. More information is at whiteflowerfarm.com.
KRNN proudly presents the broadcast of the 43rd Annual Alaska Folk Festival, kicking off on April 3rd at 7 p.m. Listen live each night on KRNN 102.7 or view the live web stream at krnn.org. This broadcast is made possible by generous support from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, Alaska Robotics, and COPA. Join us live for Folk Fest on KRNN, April 3rd through the 9th.
Right.
And welcome back to A Juno Afternoon, where I'm joined by Maria Celi from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And, Maria, you're here because the home show's happening.
It's happening tonight and all day tomorrow and Sunday. So
it was
such
a big deal. Have you been over to Centennial yet to see all the stuff getting built and all these booths? And
I'm just about to head over there to this afternoon.
It's always quite a, I mean, that's almost like that's a show in and of itself, just to see what people are displaying and building and the booths and all that. You have the best builders in Juneau all putting together booths, so it's pretty fun.
Yeah, the builders are fantastic. We're really happy to be part of this and supporting that industry and being able to see all the different types of energy efficiencies, the modifications that are out there. So it's a great opportunity.
Which Alaska Housing Finance Corporation gets involved in all that stuff, but you're specifically going to be doing a kind of a seminar on financing a renovation specifically.
Yeah, we actually have renovation options that are out there, so we're going to be doing a seminar on Sunday afternoon at 12:45, and we're also having the booth going on, but we will be talking about, for home buyers, how do I buy that house that has the carpeting, the 1970 Shea carpeting with the orange flex in it, and I don't want to live that way anymore. I want to modernize.
Refrigerator,
so,
yeah.
Exactly. So we have programs for that. We also have programs for homeowners to either do a second mortgage or refi, and so we're going to provide a lot more clarity.
Yeah, what are some of the things that people have to consider for a renovation versus just a regular mortgage?
Well, for the regular mortgage, if somebody is purchasing, there is the down payment option, or they'll put a minimum of 5% down on a conventional loan, and then they get up to $50,000 to do some renovations. So that's a really nice kitchen, bathroom, or a combination of both. We see a lot of people that want to do new carpeting or different types of flooring out there and more of an open concept.
Can a renovation include an addition, or is renovation specifically on the same footprint?
It could be an addition. We've had people do them, but when we're talking about a $50,000 cap, there's
only so much you can do.
It's going to have to be. We've had people that were in the industry, and they've been able to do those for very cheap because they're able to save on the labor, but there's also other options available.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it could mean a new bedroom or a wider kitchen or something to that effect. So
that stuff's always so exciting to think about, you know, looking at your house and saying, well, if we redid this or redid that.
Well, you know, the housing market is, a lot of it was built in the 70s and 80s, so we're getting on close to 40 years old, and so the bulk of that market needs a little bit of upgrading.
Yeah.
And one of the things that a lot of people are doing, not only here in Alaska, but nationwide, is being able to use their equity in their home for homeowners and be able to do some of those renovations. So we'll be talking about some of those options
as well. And one more time, tell us the time for the talk that you're going to be doing and when people can find out this information.
We are going to be we'll have a booth all day, so
okay.
If you come on down, we'll be there and we'll remind you of the session. But I'm going to be doing the seminar on Sunday at 12:45.
Sunday 12:45 is a seminar specifically on financing renovations, and it's Maria Celi with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Maria, have a great home show, and thanks for coming in and letting us know about it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Ma, yeah, yeah,
All right, Mockingbird. Let's talk about it. To Kill a Mockingbird is happening right now at Perseverance Theater, and we've got members of the cast here. We've got Scout and Dill and Atticus all here. How's it going, guys?
Good. Enrique, how are you?
Enrique Bravo is Atticus Finch. And Enrique, thanks so much for coming in. Theo is Dill. And Seth, you're Scout.
Yes.
And that's awesome.
Yeah.
Are you guys having a good time doing
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's very yeah. fun. Yeah.
I mean, it seems like an amazing play. I'm not going to talk to the adult here.
That's fine. That's fine.
But, right, so have you done a lot of them? I'm going to talk to you first.
This is actually my first professional production.
Okay, cool.
And with Perseverance, I've normally done, like, community theater, like Northern Lights Junior Theater. I did Christmas Doll.
Okay, cool.
And
so you got some experience
yeah,
uh-huh. in it, but
yeah.
but playing Scout in To Kill a Mockingbird is a big deal, right? So
yeah.
much of the play centers
yeah.
on that character, so... It's kind of a little nerve-wracking, but mm-hmm. probably kind of fun because you're in a
yeah.
lot of the scenes, right?
Yeah, and she talks a lot. She has a lot to say.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's very energetic, and she's very, very strong, and I just love her character.
Yeah, that's cool. Was there certain things that when you started thinking about playing the part and you had read the part that you think about differently now that you've kind of gotten direction on it and the director's kind of said, no, let's play it this way?
Yeah, I've learned a lot. About Scout, just like playing her and saying her lines so many times. It's just like it makes me very familiar with
yeah.
her.
That's part of the process, right? You
yeah,
want to
uh-huh.
say them so much mm-hmm. that it just becomes your own yeah. voice saying them
yeah.
in a way.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now let's talk about the Dill character.
Yeah.
Dill's a kind of really interesting character. He's kind of a weird kid, right?
He's really weird.
Yeah, which is really fun.
It's so
probably,
fun.
Yeah,
it's
probably really fun to play that.
This is one of the funnest characters I've played
yeah.
ever.
So what is it like? Is it you have to make sure you don't make him a joke though, or make him too silly or something, right?
Right. Yeah. He luckily about halfway through the play gets really like emotionally moved, which allows me to ground him.
Gets serious.
He gets
yeah,
serious.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Right.
And that helps a lot because it gives the character a ton of range and lets me be really silly and huge at the beginning so that it's even more.
Yeah, because in some ways, seeing that character kind of, especially as a child, seeing that character kind of get grounded is a really emotional experience for the...
Definitely.
For, yeah. All right, Enrique, let's talk to you, man. So, Atticus, I mean, this is, how do you play Atticus Finch?
You know.
How do you get Gregory Peck out
I
of your
know.
Head and all
I,
that?
You know, but luckily, it's kind of not the first time. I feel like the same thing happened with the whole Paul Newman and Brick, you know. So, and it really is, it comes to a point where you sort of just got to make it your own. You kind of, what is it about my Atticus? What is it, you know, so...
Did you purposefully stay away from the movie?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. I did a lot of reading on just sort of like, I read this long essay called The Moral Moral Ethology or something of Atticus. And I've just done a lot of sort of, reading of documents. Because he's just inspired so many people, like legitimate lawyers, you know. And it doesn't hurt to have a lawyer in the cast, too, with Ben
Brown.
No,
it inspires fathers, it inspires lawyers, and it
exactly.
inspires
it's just people in
just
general.
Morality and
right,
those kinds
exactly.
of things. Yeah.
So it's, the character itself has a lot to say, especially now, you know, with everything that's sort of going down now with, Black Lives Matter and just sort of some of the specific lines that, you know, Atticus speaks just ring, you know, really true in sort of today's day and age, and it's kind of, it's some of it's sort of a little, I get taken aback. I remember during the rehearsal process being like, God, how much has really changed? You know, this took place in 1935, and you say a line like, was this African-American character shot really 17 times? And it makes you think like, well, how far away is that from, you know, today's reality? And so there is definitely a lot of themes that I think people can really sort of latch onto today, and it really the timing couldn't have been perfect. So
yeah.
it's been nice jumping into that, and sort of me being a person of color as well. It's been that has been interesting for me because you know this obviously would have been normally played by a person that's white, and so it sort of hits me in a very specific way.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
yeah.
I'm gonna go through and ask each one of you this. What do you have a favorite scene that you like playing the most as Scout?
I really like the scene after the courtroom scene. It's when Miss Maudie sits down with Dill, Jim, and Scout, and she talks about the trial and how horrible it was that Tom got accused, and just being like, well, the jury stayed out so long, and I think that we took a little step.
Mm-hmm.
And just like the kids just listening to her and just trying to grasp onto reality,
yeah.
Really. You know, it was just
how
really
about
awesome.
How about Theo? How about you as Dill?
Well, mine is nowhere near as...
You can't pick the same one.
...deep as that, but I get to tell the story of running away, and I have
yeah,
a
really
ton
fun.
Of fun doing that,
right.
So that's probably my
that
favorite.
That is pretty great.
Enrique, how about you?
I think probably the courtroom scene. I mean, it's just, you
know... Not shooting the dog?
I mean, yeah, shooting the dog. We do have a real... We use a real sort of like... Not a real gun, but...
Oh, I thought you were going to say a real dog.
We go through them every night.
Oh, man, that would be awful.
Yeah.
We got a stunt dog back
there.
That
would be the worst play ever. Well, To Kill a Mockingbird, I'm going tonight because it's Beer Friday tonight, so I'll
That's
see you
awesome.
Tonight. And it's playing now, and it plays for the next couple of weeks, 3 weeks? Next 3 weeks, is that right? Amy's in here.
Yep, next
through
3 weeks.
April 15th.
All right, through April 15th, and that's it for a Juno Afternoon.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.